American Maritime Voices was created to help you speak up, show your pride, and when needed, push back. The future of maritime is in your hands, and its story needs to be told. Will you help tell it?
Welcome back to the American Maritime Podcast, powered by Big Wig Podcasts. We are glad to have you aboard. I'm your host, Jennifer Carpenter, and today we are very excited to have as our guest, Joel Whitman, president of Foss Offshore Wind, joining us for a special Earth Day episode. Joel, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I am looking forward to wonking out with you on all things maritime and offshore wind, but let's start with some basics. For folks who aren't familiar with Foss Offshore Wind, tell us a little bit about the company. When was it formed? How does it fit with the rest of the Foss organization? And what kind of work are you doing?
Certainly, yeah. Foss Offshore Wind was created 2 years ago now, maybe a little over that, specifically to address the opportunities in the offshore wind market. Foss over the years has, the company goes way back to the 1800s, has been a leader in transportation, maritime transportation. And as the offshore wind market in the U.S. was taking shape, they saw that there was an opportunity both in transportation as well as some port development. Made some investments there, put those investments into a standalone entity called Foss Offshore Wind, and here we are.
Fantastic. How about you? How did you find your way to the maritime industry and specifically to this emerging offshore wind sector?
So I've been involved in offshore wind for going on about 15 plus years. I was involved in with a British company for many years. We were another 1800s era company that had been installing telecommunications cables subsea for all that time, back since the beginning of telecommunications. And so the offshore wind market in Europe took off 15, 20 years ago now. At this point, it's hard to think about. And we diversified into that, laying power cables for array fields and export cables, the things necessary for offshore wind. Built that up, and I've been involved in the industry ever since, offshore transmission, anything related subsea. And then joined Foss 2 years ago when the company was set up. And quite frankly, I was looking for an opportunity to do something in my own backyard, and real excited to see if we could get the industry started here in the U.S. and specifically up here in New England.
Very exciting and pretty cool to see companies with a long history going way back continuing to evolve to take advantage of emerging opportunities. Tell us a little bit about some of the work that Foss is doing on the East Coast in the offshore wind space.
Yeah, well, there's two areas of focus currently. There's a very large project that most people that follow the industry have been paying attention to, called Vineyard Wind. It started installation in 2023, construction, I should say. And we are involved in that, in the transportation of the turbines from the Port of New Bedford out to the build site, which is south of Martha's Vineyard, the island of Martha's Vineyard. And so we've got a set of equipment, two sets of tugs and barges that have been specially fitted out to handle these turbines, the GE turbines that are being used at Vineyard Wind. And we've been working with our partner companies, DEME in particular. They're kind of the leader, and Barge Master, which is the company that has created some pretty innovative motion compensation technology to make it easier to pick in a broader range of seas. Long story short, we're doing that installation actually as we speak. And that project will continue on through 2024. On the other side, we also bought a derelict power plant. This is a power plant that actually could trace its roots back to Thomas Edison, believe it or not.
Wow.
In the inner harbor of New Bedford, it had been kind of derelict, I think, since the 90s. If you were going to go film a late Victorian industrial horror film, this is the building to go shoot it in. And so we bought that property and have worked very closely with the city of New Bedford and the state of Massachusetts to what we are in the process of turning that property into a offshore operations and maintenance port. That building I just described was taken down. We took down the last stack, I guess about a year ago now, and pretty much are now moving into construction phase where we're rebuilding some of the bulkhead and then the upland side as well. And that'll be in development for years to come as the industry takes shape. So those two things out of New Bedford are kind of where our current focus is.
That is some really exciting stuff. So let's talk a little bit about what gives a company like Foss the confidence to make these sort of investments. As our viewers know, or many of our viewers know, the Jones Act requires that merchandise moving between two U.S. points move on vessels that are U.S. owned, U.S. built, U.S. crewed. Can you talk a little bit, Joel, about the interface between the Jones Act and a company like Foss moving into this offshore wind space?
Absolutely. In fact, Foss Offshore Wind, Foss, and then Salchuk, our parent company, are huge supporters of the Jones Act. We believe in the importance of American maritime investment. We believe in the importance of new vessels that are made here in the United States, that are crewed by American mariners. And we see a new industry like offshore wind as a perfect opportunity to further American maritime interests, understanding that the industry can't just materialize out of nowhere. And so if you think about an offshore wind farm, you're looking at 40 different types of vessels over the, we call it, 2-year construction period. So you have a wide range of vessels required to do this work, all different types of construction vessels, transportation vessels, the whole works. So we really believe that that's a perfect opportunity for American investors, maritime investors, companies like ourselves who believe in the Jones Act, who believe in kind of American participation in kind of the world maritime infrastructure as a way for growth, as a path to growth. Quite frankly, we see it very complementary with other needs to invest to update the merchant marine fleet, to expand our need for mariners in all corners of the industry. And offshore wind is just the latest example of why maritime is important in the U.S.
Absolutely. I've heard offshore wind described as the biggest emerging market for the American domestic maritime industry in a generation. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I really would. And I would say that not just to be on the bandwagon, but that's exactly what we saw in Europe. I mean, you know, and in Europe, remember, the industry took shape in the North Sea, in the Baltic Sea, in places where the oil and gas industry was already present. And so they were able to kind of build locally, if you will, on that experience that already existed there, vessels, equipment, people. We don't have that. You know, American offshore wind is largely taking shape up here in the Northeast, Pacific Coast, you know, ocean. And what that means is that the offshore construction infrastructure, we don't have the advantage built in the European market. We have to build this from scratch. And it's an opportunity for those in the Gulf to come up here. It's an opportunity for us to learn from that experience, from your European experience. And then, quite frankly, when we go to the Pacific, where it's, you know, very deep water, to build the floating industry, which will be an entirely different set of technology, but with the same result, where you get, you know, a large scale source of renewable energy.
Sounds like there are a lot of opportunities to learn from things that have worked in Europe, to enter into partnerships with other companies that have experience in this area, but also to innovate in ways that really make sense for the U.S. market. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. You know, one of the things that I think is really important to understand is that this is offshore construction. It's not transportation. It's not cargo handling. It's construction. It's not even nearshore construction. It's offshore construction. And so building something at scale, I mean, these turbines are huge. If you come into New Bedford, you'll take, I mean, behind me, you can see that's right there is the three tower sections. Two are stacked and one next to it. These are massive structures. The blades are longer than a football field, right? So you're going to put dozens of those at sea, 40, 50, even more further offshore. That's going to create any number of opportunities for better, more efficient, more cost-effective, more higher quality ways to do something. And I really feel like we saw this in the European market where we were stealing from oil and gas, as I mentioned earlier. We were stealing from telecoms, which is where I come from. to make offshore wind work. And now there's been a new generation of equipment, a new generation of vessels that are purpose-built for this. There's absolutely no reason why that won't happen here. And then the folks that are going to be required to actually operate that stuff are also going to have to come from someplace. And I really believe that it's a great opportunity for an entirely new generation of young people that are interested in a marine career to get involved. And, you know, I'm an old war horse. The industry is just getting started. The people who are really going to build it are today literally sitting in middle school and high school. And I think this is a great opportunity for them to, they're interested in a maritime career, to get involved. And it's no doubt that their minds, their experience, their generational approach to solving problems as that takes shape is going to have any number of positive influences on making this industry very efficient and a key part of, you know, how the American population gets its energy in the future.
This is cool. And there's a lot I want to follow up on there. So let me start with some of the technology that you are employing today. You talked about your partnership with DEME and with Barge Master. Tell us a little bit about how a barge feeder operation like the one that you're using at Vineyard Wind works and some of the efficiency benefits to that. I think it's really interesting to talk about some of the different modalities out there. There are folks who say, man, the only way to do this is to take a wind turbine installation vessel and use that to transport, the turbines out to the site and then install them. You're doing something completely different. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, I would say there's no right way, one right way to do it. It's all going to be situational. It's going to be where is the wind farm being built in relation to the port, the main laydown port? Where are the support vessels going to be coming from for that? And what kind of a weather environment are you intending to work through? We start factoring those things in. A one-size-fits-all solution is it doesn't exist. You have the feeder system that was created, but it creates an efficiency in terms of the jackup in European projects will jack down, go get a full supply, come back out. So the jackup is constantly moving back and forth. Well, that requires ports that can actually take the jackup. And we don't have those ports in the Northeast either. And so you really have to design the installation solution to take advantage of the local ports, the local weather conditions, the local capabilities. And that's going to be unique to each area. So in our case, we worked very closely with our partners and with the developer to design a system that can fit, you know, through the specific parameters that New Bedford throws up. The laydown yard for these turbines is here in New Bedford. We have a hurricane barrier in New Bedford, which is, as it sounds like, is a narrowing of the front of the harbor that basically protects the city from hurricanes barreling through. And because of that, we had to design a solution where our barges needed to be able to get the permission from all the relevant authorities, Army Corps, U.S. Navy, Coast Guard, working with the local harbor authorities to transit that fully loaded, unloaded. But then once you've transited that, you steam out to site, and then you need to moor out at the jackup. And then you need to be able to pick the turbine components off the back of the barge in a range of sea states.
That is really interesting. So you are really working to develop solutions that not only fit within U.S. law, the Jones Act, but also U.S. port geography and operational conditions. I think that's a really important point.
Yep. Yeah, it can't be underestimated how demanding offshore wind is on port infrastructure as well. That's one reason why we were getting involved in it, because the ports that we have up here, I can't speak to other parts of the country, but the ports that we have up here were never designed for this type of construction. There was a day when we had a lot of shipbuilding in the Northeast, but that, you know, since the Second World War, that really hasn't been the case. Now, down in the Gulf, you have ports that are specifically designed for the oil and gas industry, and that took shape over decades. So we will experience the same learning curve and the same investment curve. And I think over time, the ports here will be able to offer kind of the infrastructure necessary to build and, most importantly, maintain these wind farms. Because remember, that once they start running, they're running for 20-year PPA, and I think that they'll be repowered after that. So this is an industry that's going to be here for decades to come. And so the port infrastructure is going to be paramount to making sure we can keep everything running and keep it running in a safe and kind of a high quality production way.
Absolutely. And Joel, you know, you're involved right now at this early stage installation of projects like Vineyard Wind. But can you talk about some of the other maritime opportunities, some of the other vessel types that are going to be needed throughout the offshore wind cycle, operation, yeah, maintenance?
Yeah, the CTVs get a lot of the headlines because crew transfer vessels, they're comparatively inexpensive, and they're something that you need a lot of. And so that's one opportunity that gets talked about a lot. And then the complete other end, the other bookend to that, is the turbine installation vessel. If I build it, will the turbines outsize it, and then it won't be that useful after a few years? So there's a whole bunch of, and you're starting to see the turbine manufacturers, I think, take that into account and start settling at some certain sizes. So there's some maturity happening on that side too, but there's this huge middle, and the middle is PSVs, basically flatbacks that can be used, DP flatbacks that can be used for all kinds of construction support, large ones, big decks that could be due for burial, seabed characterization and early survey work, cable burial, mattressing, rock placement. There's a number, vessels that are purpose built for that are hyper efficient. Others that are vessels of opportunity that can be mobilized. And then you're also seeing ones that we're really interested in are shallow water vessels that can, you know, multi-catch, things that can really work in shallow situations at a nearshore basis, things that can hold station, all kinds of opportunities for vessels to get involved.
So what needs to happen in order to facilitate that investment? I know we've seen the cancellation of some offshore wind projects that were bid during a completely different interest rate climate. What needs to happen in order to give folks the confidence to make the investments needed to reach some of the really ambitious goals that have been set for offshore wind power production?
That's a great question. And I would argue it's maybe one of the most important questions. You know, remember, a lot of the development to this point in offshore wind has focused on developers who are utilities creating a utility scale infrastructure offshore. Makes sense. That's the business. However, the way it's done on land is not the way that it's obviously done in the ocean. And so in Europe, as I mentioned earlier, you had a lot of infrastructure, a lot of vessels that you could just tap from oil and gas that were local available that you could kind of get started with. We don't have that luxury here. So my personal opinion is that given the volume of projects, you know, state of Massachusetts has a 9+ gigawatt commitment, New York similar, even maybe even larger, I can't keep track, keeps changing, Rhode Island, Connecticut, New Jersey are all very committed to, you know, just in those states alone, you're looking at 30+ gigawatts, which is a lot, right? I think that if you look at a single project, how many vessel days, you know, vessels, maritime investments, all about vessel utilization. And if you look at a single project, ask yourself, all these fancy vessels we just talked about included, how many vessel days does that up to? Well, it's thousands of vessel days. And if you actually thought about that and said, well, state of Massachusetts, state of New York, how do you, you're the customer here, you're buying thousands of vessel days worth of work in order to build this. How do you turn that into an investment strategy so that American companies can take advantage of that? Because as of today, those thousands of vessel days have a high proportion of European vessels getting that work, which is expected to, in an early stage market. But I would think as we move forward and you move to project 2 and 3 and 7 and 10 and 12, each project should have a higher proportion of American vessel days. And I really do believe if we thought of it as a maritime industry that way and worked with the state so that they can procure, whether it's through the PPA, power purchase agreements or other vehicles, they can procure enough vessel days to justify the investment. I mean, we're going to be in construction on these things for at least a decade plus, and then we're going to be in maintenance on the same things for decades to come. So the days are there, but they need to be thought of from a maritime investment point of view. And I think we in industry need to do a better job at making that case.
I hope you sign up for American Maritime Voices. It's our ways to be heard on issues that we care about in Washington. I did it, and it was easy.
Becoming a voice allows me to be heard in issues that matter most to me. Don't just sign up. Have your friends and colleagues sign up, too.
I signed up for American Maritime Voices. It's easy. You can, too.
American Maritime Voices keeps me updated on issues in Washington. It's good to know I have a voice, too.
I'm proud to work in the U.S. Maritime Ministry, and with Voices, we get our voices heard.
The winds of change are blowing towards a sustainable future, and the U.S. offshore wind industry is harnessing that power. At the brink of a new era of growth, the time to act is now. Join me, Jennifer Carpenter, at Reuters Events Offshore Wind USA 2024 in Boston from June 17th through the 18th. Over 500 industry changemakers will be there to propel the offshore wind sector forward. Navigate the winds of policy and regulation, master the currents of cost and supply chain, and overcome the barrier to enter a growing domestic energy future. Stay ahead of the curve, secure your projects, and build the future with confidence. Be part of the premier business-focused event tailor-made for those ready to lead in the U.S. offshore wind sector. Reuters Events Offshore Wind USA 2024, where vision meets opportunity. Secure your spot today. The future is renewable. The future is now. I look forward to seeing you there.
Thousands of global decision makers rely on Maritime Reporter and MarineLink.com every day to bring them trusted news and expert insights about the global maritime industry. Let Maritime Reporter help you achieve your marketing goals. Visit MarineLink.com to learn more.
Faith in the news media has been challenged, making it even harder to get stories told. The Friday Reporter podcast was created to help audiences better understand the media by hosting journalists who will answer the questions to which we need answers. Join me every Friday to hear more.
Let's talk a little bit about port infrastructure investment. A lot of money been made available through the Inflation Reduction Act for port infrastructure development. Is it enough? Is more needed? Is it being channeled in the right ways? I thought you made some really interesting points about, some of the existing port infrastructure constraints that especially the East Coast faces as we try to build out offshore wind.
Sure. You know, it's quickly moving from a state-by-state argument to a regional argument. We saw this. Now New England's going to be procuring regionally, which makes a ton of sense. And then you have New York and New Jersey, and New Jersey has got a market that's centered both in the north, but ideally they put a huge investment down in the southern part of the state, which, again, is a really important foundation that we can build on. Personally, I think that the port investment that's happened to date is excellent. I think that these states are putting their money where their mouth is and getting a good start. As you mentioned, we've had a reset in the market. You know, none of those projects have been abandoned. The PPAs were abandoned. And I think those projects are working to rebid or come back into the market with a financial model that makes sense to 2024 and beyond, as opposed to, what pre-COVID, which was a very different world. And some of them will thrive, maybe others won't. But I think all of those projects have the support of their various states. So I think that we will continue to develop the ports as we go. I think that we don't need to be so far in front of that it's all speculative. But I do think that we need to think holistically about it. It's just not, let's build a port for a project. Doesn't make any sense to do it that way. It's let's build a port for a market. How it's build a port for a program. So how do we think about that regionally? What are the ports in New England, for example, that are ideal for construction ports, that are ideal for O&M ports? And then how do we work so that I'm not competing with, Salem, Massachusetts, or even Providence, Rhode Island? I'm not. There is enough opportunity and work for everybody in the area to thrive. So how do we work together as a state and as a region so that our ports are developed holistically and we're not creating too much of one thing and not enough of another? I do also think that emission standards are going to be a key ingredient in how we develop offshore construction around here. And as we think about that, proximity, new vessels, with managing emissions in ways that older vessels didn't is going to be important. But then proximity to port, so that how can I have good ports that are as close to the build area as possible, makes a ton of sense. And so if you look at Southern New England, we've got offshore wind south of Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, and all, yes, it's a number of different projects with a number of different developers, but it's contiguous. Mm-hmm. The whole point is to make it contiguous, and we should be able to be very efficient when it comes to port staging and operations and maintenance, because unlike the European market, where it's scattered all over the place, different countries, different locations, ours is in one area, primarily right now in one area, certainly Southern New England, and you have the New York Bight and other areas, where I think we can get a lot of port efficiencies if we work together and think programmatically. But it requires states to really think like, really work with maritime kind of industry to think through, well, what makes an attractive investment for you to come to town? In Europe, we had less of a problem. Like I said, there was a lot of oil and gas overlap. Here, you know, up in New England, we haven't done offshore construction in an awfully long time. And I think that there's an opportunity for industry to work even closer with states to make the case.
Those are great points. I mean, we are just building out something new in this country. And, you know, the same goes for workforce. Talk a little bit, Joel, about what you're seeing on the workforce front, both in terms of needs and challenges as we try to grow the workforce needed to serve this new industry, but also opportunities and anything that you want to share about what Foss Offshore Wind is doing to bring those opportunities to bear.
Yeah, after vessels and vessel making the vessel investment, I think workforce is just underneath vessels as far as A1 priority. I really believe it's been my experience. Let me say it this way. It's been my experience that younger people are very tuned in to climate change and how the changing climate is going to affect them in their lifetime and their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. My experience has been when you're talking to young people of younger generation than me, they are very, very much interested in what can we do to make something better? How do we fix what we've broken, or how do we improve on our past performance? However you want to look at it. So I think there's a real sense of stewardship that these particular younger generations have. And I think offshore wind offers a perfect opportunity to do that, that you are looking at young people looking for a career, get involved in an industry where you're actually physically doing something. We're going to have electricity to come. Our society depends on it. This is a way to produce electricity that doesn't degrade the environment. That's a really good idea. And quite frankly, the states up here are really committed to it. I mean, we don't have a domestic fuel supply in New England. It's, you know, we import all of our fuel anyway. So this is a first for us to be doing this here in New York, New Jersey, same thing. It's a first for us to really be supplying a lot of our own fuel ourselves, taking it on ourselves, building an industry of our own people in our own state and our own region. That's exciting stuff. So I really think that the industry needs to work with the rest of the maritime industry. So offshore wind needs to work with the rest of the maritime industry to make the case to young people that this is a great industry for you. There are jobs, not just jobs, careers. And whether it's back office stuff or, you know, project planning or project development or actual union labor in the field, whether it's maritime unions or construction trades, there is a huge number of jobs, work that's going to be required that requires significant amount of training and preparation in order to do it safely. The combination, quite frankly, of the construction trades and the maritime trades at sea is, I think, a new thing in many ways. So that, again, these are all great opportunities. And if we that are in senior positions today recognize it and we work together to tell the story correctly, I don't think there'll be any lack of interest and enthusiasm for young people to get involved. But we have to do that. We can't just expect them to show up and say, hey, give me a job and tell me about this. How do I get involved in this industry? So my experience has been when we make the pitch correctly and we talk to people, they're excited. They want to get involved, whether it's at the elementary school level, middle school, high school, technical trade school, community college, you know, whatever. They're all very interested.
It's just really exciting, the opportunities ahead. And, you know, a lot of those are going to be available to folks who live in coastal communities where offshore wind is being built. But I think it's really interesting, too, to think about the career opportunities that are going to exist and be supported throughout the offshore wind supply chain, which is going to penetrate to, you know, all parts of the country, inland regions, shipbuilding, manufacturing. Can you talk a little bit about some of those other job opportunities that offshore wind is going to make possible?
Yeah, you make a great point. Remember, onshore wind is a huge industry, and it's not something that we do here at the coast at all at any scale. I mean, there's the random turbine, but not like you have in Texas. I mean, I think they throw off 20 gigawatts or some huge number of gigawatts of wind power already that they've been doing. They developed the industry. Iowa, I think some days it's 100% wind power in a place like that. So these are parts of the country that are very familiar with the supply chain, very familiar with, even though the turbine designs are different, sizes are different, the concepts are still the same. And so there is no end of opportunity for American supply chains to get involved, whether it's, you know, the foundation design and building construction, all the vessel stuff we talked about, whether it's the turbines themselves or all the equipment required to install and maintain them. There are lots and lots of opportunities for those that are currently in onshore wind to make a play for the offshore wind supply chain, for those that are currently involved in other types of energy production to get involved in this, if you're interested in this, you know, energy production in this part of the country. So I really see this as you're exactly right. I really see this as a coastal, you know, coastal communities are where it's going to be built, but the ability for us to have a positive influence across, you know, states and supply chains and businesses in the U.S. is really high. And we saw this in Europe, and I would like nothing more than to see the percentage of U.S. components and every offshore wind project to grow percentage by percentage every single time we go out and build something. You know, it should be the vessels, it should be the ports, it should be the people, and it should be all the equipment and the tools. And only with states working together with industry and thinking at scale will we get that. But it'll happen. It'll happen. You know, this is a brand new thing. And like I said, we're just getting started. And I think that as we you learn from our, you know, early projects and move into the next one, we do have the advantage of an industry that's been going for 15 years in Europe. So we hopefully won't make the same mistakes they made. By learning that way and taking advantage of their best practices, but then adapting that for the American market, the American supply chain, it should be a very, very positive part of our kind of energy economy.
Really exciting stuff. Joel, can you say a word about floating offshore wind, which is going to be needed on the West Coast or in the Gulf of Maine, places with really deep water where we can't fix turbines to the sea floor? Speaking of areas where some technological innovation is going to be needed.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same turbines, the foundations and the subsea components are all unique to that. And you're talking anything over a couple hundred feet of water, although what you're really looking at of California is 700, 800 feet, you know, and beyond, and Hawaii is over 1,000, 1,500, really, really deep. The issues around that, the technology, in my opinion, the technology is there. It's been being proven in the European and the Asian markets for a while now. It's the ability to scale and the ability to kind of manufacture and assemble. See, the big difference in a floating wind farm is that you're good, the port, talk about port development, the port is going to be the place where you do the turbine assembly. Whereas for offshore wind with a fixed base, which is what we do here in the East Coast, you do the assembly out at sea, put the foundation in, and then you assemble it with a turbine installation vessel. What'll happen on the floating market is you'll have a port that's developed to do that assembly at the port, and then it'll be towed to location, anchored to the seabed, and then the cables will be daisy chained together. So the issues are really unique to that at scale. Individually, a lot of that technology, anchoring in deep water, cabling, dynamic cables that are permanently suspended in the water column. These are things that have existed in oil and gas for a long time. The difference is scale, you know, that you're not talking about one or two oil rigs that are cabled back to shore. You're talking about hundreds of turbines that need to be placed so that they're not interfering with marine life, so they're not interfering with, transit, navigation, becoming a navigational hazard. They can be maintained, and that they can, you know, they can have the long life necessary to make the whole investment worth it. So I really believe that the challenges in floating are going to be unique to that, will require an entirely different approach to assembly and installation. But at the same point, by the same token, once you have it, you're going to be really looking at scale. That, you know, out here we have a, we have limitations on the water depth. You know, if you're going to, we have the continental shelf, and that's why we have the comparatively shallow water. We can do fixed base. If you can figure out how to do a floating wind farm at scale, and you can put it in proximity to a major metro area, that's a great solution to energy production. You know, certainly renewable energy production, which is something that the West Coast really is prioritizing. Also, remember that the transmission infrastructure to make this all happen has to be solved. And so, how do I get a gigawatt or plus coming from the ocean back to shore? And none of our transmission infrastructure was ever designed to take volumes of energy from that direction. So how do we make that happen? How do we work? So it's a combination of design and permitting and maintenance that will allow us to keep it all running. It's not without its challenges, but if you're interested in, like we said, innovative emerging stuff, I mean, it's all manageable. It's all within the realm of physics. It just needs to be figured out.
That is really cool. So where there is opportunity, there is also competition. Brag a little bit. What is Foss Offshore Wind doing to distinguish itself in this emerging marketplace? What do you think you do particularly well?
I think one of the things that I've been proud to be part of this company joining just a couple of years ago is building on our tradition. We as Foss have a reputation. We're a quality provider. We've been doing what we do as far as transportation and Saltchuk, our parent, as far as a range of heavy industry for a century and a half as various components of the parts of the company. We're always known as, in my opinion, and from what I've heard and what I've experienced, we're known as a quality provider. We take care of people. We prioritize safety. Operating in maritime is the second most dangerous place, right? Space is the only one that's more dangerous. And I'd like to believe, and I think the data will show, that we at Foss are a quality, safe operator. And at the same time, we can innovate in a new thing and try new things without undue risk. And so I'm really proud of the steps that we've taken. We're a new market, emerging market for the U.S. We've made some very important bets. We're not going to try to be all things to all people. We're going to try to stay in our lane and do what we do best. But I do think that we are out there trying to make something new happen in a way that is American. You know, it's a lot of my colleagues and a lot of the people that are building wind in the U.S. are Europeans, and I love them dearly, but I would love to see more American companies get involved. And I'm happy to be and proud to be part of a company that has decided to be at the vanguard of that effort.
Oh, man. Hear, hear. So since we are commemorating Earth Day, anything else you want to highlight about the work that either Foss Offshore Wind or Foss Maritime generally is doing to support safe, efficient, clean transportation in the U.S.?
I think I appreciate being here on Earth Day because obviously I'm in the offshore wind business, so I think about that. But I really think that this notion of stewardship is important. You know, there is no other planet, right? We oftentimes, especially on a day like Earth Day, we're talking about the environment, but it's not the environment. It's our environment. And let's face it, nature can do just as well without us as with us. And so what we're really trying to protect, what we're really trying to get our mind around, and how do we have a minimal impact on our environment, the environment that allows people to live and to thrive. And I think we increasingly recognize that the environment is changing. We can argue about the causes, but the reality is the environment is changing. That environment is going to change for the worse for human beings. The environment has been around for 13, 14 billion years. It'll keep going after it's done away with us if we choose to do away with ourselves. And so my advocacy for my industry and our company is, where are the ways, whether it's designing vessels, designing fuels, utilization of fuels, designing back office infrastructure, designing the way that we do things in the future, so to have the least amount of impact on our environment, so that in case of the ocean, in the case of the air above the ocean, we're being responsible stewards of the environment that we're allowed to work in. It's a privilege to work on the ocean. It's a privilege to do what we do. And I think we need to show increasing amounts of respect for that. I think as we become aware of our impact on the environment or on our environment, to my point, we need to take responsibility and take action. And it's easy to point to the past and say, oh, those guys, look at all the terrible things that they did in previous generations. Maybe they didn't really know. Maybe they couldn't believe that we would have this cumulative impact on the environment. I have no idea, but we are aware of it today, and we have a responsibility to be good stewards so that how we do our business takes advantage of that best practice, develop the best practice, and commit to really doing it in these ways that we can be proud of, so that our great-great-grandchildren can have, you know, things like clean air and clean water and an environment that they can thrive in, just like we've had. So I would say that, you know, I'm proud to be part of Salchuk and FOSS, and we prioritize this, we invest in this, and this is a key part of what it means to come to work at my company, and I'm really happy to be part of that.
Joel, thank you so much. I can't think of a better way to close out our Earth Day podcast than that. Really appreciate you joining us. Really appreciate our audience being here for this episode of the American Maritime Podcast. We hope that you will share today's podcast with others. We also hope that you will sign up to be a voice on maritime issues like those you heard about today. Please go to AmericanMaritimeVoices.org. Check it out. Find out how you can help spread the good word about what the maritime industry does for us today and for the future. Again, Joel, thank you so much. I'm Jennifer Carpenter, signing off.
On any given day in Washington, policy proposals are created, debated, and decimated by tens of thousands of people and organizations working behind the scenes. On 80 Proof Politics, a guest and I will visit a D.C. watering hole and distill the art of advocacy by pulling back the curtain a bit and taking a look at how they play their part in the sausage factory we call our federal government. So if you're at all interested in how the sausage is made, pull up a chair, grab a drink, and join us. After all, what goes better with sausage than a tall, cold one?